Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, Mike Herrick has a 13-year-old daughter who enjoys using her smartphone all the time. His daughter often sends text messages to her friends, even if they are sitting a few meters apart. At times like those, he wonders about the effects that technology has on people, especially children. Herrick is a product and engineering executive at Urban Airship, a mobile technology company in Portland, Oregon. He told the Associated Press, "The power of this age we live in is that it has given everyone access to all this information and the ability to stay connected to people. But how do we manage it better?" Other technology executives have similar questions. Many say they enjoy their work, but they also are concerned about the addictive nature of mobile devices and social media. The Pew Research Center released a study in August about what parents think about technology in the lives of their children. The study found that about 66% of U.S. parents worry that their teenage children spend too much time with computers or mobile devices. 72% of parents said they thought their teenagers were sometimes distracted by their phones when talking with them. But 86% of parents said they are very or somewhat sure they permit the right amount of phone or computer time for their children. The study said 36% of parents admit to spending too much time on phones themselves. Apple is trying to assist with some of the problems it helped create when it first released the iPhone in 2007. The company is offering more ways for parents to observe and control how much time they and their kids spend on the devices. New tools are available to keep children from using applications like Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram completely or just at certain times of the day. Google included similar controls in its latest version of the Android operating system, which most of the world's smartphones use. Kevin Systrom is one of the founders of the mobile phone application Instagram. He is already promising to limit his 10-month-old daughter's use of devices and social media as she grows up. But Systrom also hopes his daughter will accept technology as he did when he began using computers and the internet as a boy. He says his early interest in technology led him to create Instagram. The application now has more than 1 billion users worldwide. Systrom said, "Moderation is key. I think we are in a world where we have to develop opinions on what that moderation is and how to do it." Brian Peterson is the co-founder and vice president of engineering at Dialpad, a telephone technology company. He gave both of his daughters iPads when they were 2 years old. At first, they were using applications that helped them to learn skills, like playing a piano. But a few years later, things changed. Peterson noticed the girls spent most of their time watching YouTube videos or doing other things that he and their mother wished they would not do. Now, Peterson has decided not to get the girls' smartphones until they are older. He said, I am just praying by the time that my kids really need a smartphone, they have really good parental controls.
American comedian George Carlin is remembered for telling jokes about politics, religion, and even the English language. He used humor to express his dislike of things such as misused words and the overuse of common expressions. One of his pet peeves was when television reporters and program hosts used redundancies. The word redundancy has a few meanings. The one we will explore today involves use of a word or phrase that repeats something else and is not needed. Carlin made fun of redundant phrases such as honest truth, plan ahead, and join together in his stand-up comedy act and books. On this Everyday Grammar program, we will talk about common redundancies and suggest ways to avoid them in writing. English speakers often speak in a repetitive style. It is so deeply ingrained in us that we rarely notice it. In fact, I just used a somewhat redundant phrase, deeply ingrained. So, why do English speakers use redundancy? Well, we sometimes do it for emphasis. One might say, personally, I would rather go to the parade. The word personally is unneeded, but makes a stronger statement. Other times, redundancy makes very direct language sound kinder, such as in indirect questions. Redundant language also is used in some forms of writing, such as literature, speech writing, and legal writing. But in other kinds of formal writing, redundancy is not a good idea. That includes school-related and business writing. It can weaken statements and make readers lose interest in the subject. Less is more is a good rule to follow as one attempts to produce quality written work. So now, let's explore five common redundancies to look out for. The first one is in setting up examples. In formal writing, we use phrases like for example, for instance, and such as to present examples. So adding the phrases and so on, and more, or the Latin term etc. to a list of examples is redundant. Here is an example of what to avoid.
Carlin often joked about redundant phrases, such as honest truth, plan ahead, and join together, and more.
You can rewrite it by removing the phrase such as, or, and more. You don't need both. Another problem happens when trying to present additional information on a subject. When starting a sentence with phrases such as, in addition to, like, or also, one should avoid using one of these same phrases in the statement. Here is an example of what not to write.
In addition to condemning the violence, they also protested the new policies.
You should remove the word also
in the second part of the sentence, since in addition to already expresses the idea of also. Another problem is what are called redundant pairs, two words that together suggest each other. This includes a phrase such as future plans. We know, for instance, that plans are about the future. End result and final outcome are other examples. Redundant pairs can also involve putting a useless preposition after a verb. Think of the phrase protest against. The verb protest already expresses the idea of being against something. Another kind of redundancy is the overuse or misuse of adverbs. The adverbs very, really, extremely, and incredibly are examples of intensifiers. They make adjectives stronger. Intensifiers are often not a wise choice for formal writing, however. Very unique is an example of a misused intensifier. The word very is redundant because unique means very special or unusual. Other adverbs are simply needless. Two such examples are the phrases shouted loudly and completely destroyed. We know that destruction suggests total ruin, and shouting refers to being very loud. Writers in English are also guilty of wordy, time-related phrases. For example, the phrase period of time and time period are redundant since period refers to a measure of time. A few others are at the present time, which can be replaced with at present, delay until later, which can be replaced with delay, and since the time when, which can be replaced with since. Now let's hear an example of a sentence that uses more words than necessary to express an idea. It comes from the Purdue University Online Writing Lab.
Before the travel agent was completely able to finish explaining the various differences among all of the many very unique vacation packages his travel agency was offering, the customer changed her future plans.
And here is how Purdue suggests rewriting it.
Before the travel agent finished explaining the differences among the unique vacation packages his travel agency was offering, the customer changed her plans.
The rewritten sentence is shorter and clearer. Here are three things that may help you avoid redundancy in formal written work. First, plan time to write. This will give you space to carefully examine and rewrite your work until you are satisfied with the result. Starting a formal writing task late is never a good idea. Choose your words wisely. As you write, use words that help remove redundant language. Instead of writing very tired, for instance, write exhausted. Instead of looked closely, you might write examined. And finally, avoid fillers, words and phrases that add no meaning but just fill space, such as wordy time phrases. Supervisors and professors usually disapprove of and can easily identify fillers. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Lyndon Johnson. He was the vice president under John F. Kennedy. Many Americans recognize Johnson from a photograph of his swearing-in on November 22, 1963. Kennedy had just been shot during a visit to Dallas, Texas. Johnson and his wife also were visiting the city. After doctors announced that Kennedy had died, the Johnsons were taken to the presidential airplane. There, Johnson took the oath of office as president. Men wearing suits look on, while three women stand around him. His wife, Lady Bird Johnson, is at one side. Former First Lady Jackie Kennedy is at the other. She is still wearing clothing covered with her husband's blood. The judge who is administering the oath, Sarah Hughes, stands in front of Lyndon Johnson. She holds a prayer book on which Johnson places one hand and swears to follow the Constitution. The photograph showed the American people that the federal government could and would continue in an orderly way. But Johnson's position was difficult. Many people were shocked and in mourning for the assassinated president. Johnson promised to continue many of Kennedy's reforms. He went on to use the public sympathy for Kennedy to pass additional legislation, especially in the area of civil rights. In the next election, Johnson was elected president in his own right. But as the conflict in Vietnam increased and some Americans rejected Johnson's reforms, he found his position difficult again. Lyndon Baines Johnson was born in Texas, where his family had lived for generations. A town called Johnson was even named after his relatives. Lyndon was the oldest of five children. His mother was a teacher and writer, and his father was a farmer and political leader. In time, the Johnson family experienced financial difficulties. They had little money to give their children much of an education, but Lyndon was able to attend a teaching college. Johnson excelled as a teacher. He also learned from his students. Many were even poorer than he was. They also faced discrimination because they came from Mexican families. Johnson promised to help them. But he found he could do more to improve people's lives as a politician than as a teacher. He volunteered for some political campaigns, became an aide to a member of the United States Congress, and in time became a member of Congress himself. Along the way, he married a woman named Claudia Taylor, but everyone called her Lady Bird. They went on to have two daughters. Johnson served for 12 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. In 1948, he was narrowly elected to the Senate, becoming one of the two senators from the state of Texas. From there, Johnson rose quickly. He took on increasingly important jobs in the Senate. By 1954, he was the Senate Majority Leader, the Democratic Party's top spokesman in the Senate. The Senate website notes that the person with that job needs to be able to work well with others, especially members of other parties. Historians also note that Johnson worked very hard and was always prepared. A well-known biography of Johnson is called Master of the Senate. The book describes Johnson as extremely ambitious, sometimes cruel, and often willing to praise others to get what he wanted. At the same time, he could be very concerned about other people's well-being. In other words, The picture of Johnson is a complicated one. In 1960, he competed against John F. Kennedy for the Democratic presidential nomination. Johnson lost that race, but the party asked him to be their vice presidential candidate instead. Johnson agreed, not knowing that in a little more than 3 years, he would enter the White House as president. After being sworn in, Johnson used his political experience in the Senate to pass a number of reforms. They were aimed at carrying on, in his words, a war on poverty. The new laws created health care and education programs. They also used federal money to make food less costly for some people and to train workers for jobs. Johnson also continued the work Kennedy began by signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The act made segregation because of race, religion, or national origin illegal. The Civil Rights Act also made it illegal for employers to discriminate against someone because of race, religion, national origin, or gender. The reforms had their critics, then and today. But in the presidential election of 1964, Johnson won by the widest margin of popular votes in American history. Historian Kent Germany says that vote gave the Democrats a rare opening to pass a comprehensive liberal program. Johnson had a name for such a program. He called it the Great Society. He said, "The United States should aim not only to be a rich and powerful society, but also to end poverty and racial injustice." Johnson followed his earlier reforms with others. They sought to prevent crime, reduce pollution, support the arts, make roads safer, and protect American consumers against bad products. His administration also created an immigration policy that valued family members, skilled workers, and refugees. Johnson also signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It sought to lift the barriers that had long prevented African American men and women from exercising their right to vote. Later, Johnson removed legal discrimination in the process of buying and renting homes. Together, these actions have linked Johnson to the civil rights movement in the minds of many Americans. Yet, Johnson is also strongly linked to another part of U.S. history, often known simply as Vietnam. Earlier presidents had ordered U.S. military action in the conflict between North and South Vietnam. Since 1950, Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy had slowly increased the American intervention. Their goal was to prevent the spread of communism in Southeast Asia. President Johnson continued Kennedy's policies. He also received the support of Congress to do whatever was necessary to protect U.S. forces and prevent further aggression by North Vietnam's communist government. Yet, when he was a presidential candidate in 1964, Johnson promised not to increase U.S. involvement and send young Americans to fight in Vietnam. The opposite happened. Over the next 4 years, Johnson called on hundreds of thousands of additional U.S. troops to fight on the ground and in the air. The North Vietnamese fought back, both on the battlefield and politically. In time, the American public withdrew their support of the struggle and their support for the president. By early 1968, Johnson had become deeply unpopular with voters. His party lost seats in Congress, and Johnson lost his ability to persuade lawmakers to support the measures he proposed. In addition, the U.S. economy was showing signs of weakness, partly because of the costs of the conflict in Vietnam and government spending at home. As the presidential nominating process began in early 1968, Johnson was permitted to seek another 4-year term. But he announced that he would not seek or accept his party's nomination. Shortly after, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed. Angered by his murder, people in more than 100 cities rioted. Then, in June, John Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, was also assassinated. Kennedy had been competing for the Democrats' nomination for president. His death and Johnson's withdrawal added to the divisions in the Democratic Party. Several groups gathered to protest at the party's nominating convention in Chicago. The meeting ended in violent clashes between protesters and police. By the time Johnson left office in January 1969, his party had lost control of the White House, and many Americans believed the country was in disarray. After he left the presidency, Johnson returned to his home in Texas. He wrote his memories about his White House years and made preparations for his presidential library. But he did not live much longer. He died in 1973, hours before the U.S. involvement in Vietnam officially came to a close. Johnson was a complex person, and his image in the mind of many Americans is just as complicated. His policies opened new paths for many people, but also led to years of death and destruction in Vietnam. As a president, he acted powerfully and often independently, and succeeded in passing an unusually large number of reforms. But he also failed to persuade many Americans to accept some of those measures. Supporters of the free market especially strongly rejected the government controls Johnson enacted. Even some in his Democratic Party, which Johnson had controlled for years, lost faith in him. In 1964, anti-war activists changed his campaign slogan, "All the Way with LBJ." Instead, they said, "Part of the Way with LBJ." And by 1968, they were saying, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?"
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.